This is one of my top passions in what I do. Just a brief intro of myself. I won't spend too much time talking about me, but I'm a faculty professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. I teach for the Department of Media Arts and Worship, and my specific area there is on the theology of story, theology of film. We take a group of students to the Sundance Film Festival. I teach on integrating faith and the power of story. I teach on theology of beauty, theology of creativity, and theology of art, as well as I teach creative writing and art making with biblical foundations. I have a background in Los Angeles, where I spent 18 years in Hollywood. I ministered to filmmakers, entertainment professionals, fine artists. I'm a fine artist myself as well. And I taught workshops on this subject at a number of film studios, Warner Brothers, Netflix Studios, CBS Studios Backlot, on this subject here for directors and writers. And this was my dissertation topic, theology of heroes and villains. So it was the focus of my dissertation. From there, it expanded also to other areas of story and philosophy of story. So my passion in this is, on one hand, to see God's sovereignty in storytelling. And what we're going to deal with is the specifics of two archetypes, the hero and the villain, which mainly means protagonist and antagonist, or hero and the shadow archetype is the technical term for it. The other side of it is to see how it relates to two parts, spiritual formation, how it speaks to us in our own spiritual formation, growth, character development, as well as the second part of that second part is how you engage with culture. What do our heroes and villains say about our society? How do we understand society by the stories we tell and who our heroes are and who our villains are, okay? And if you have watched films, read novels, over time, some of those heroes and villains shift a bit. And at the same time, there's a constancy amongst the whom we define our heroes and whom we define to be villains, all right? So I'm gonna do things a little bit differently. Where I'm going to use my tablet for the whole entire session. What you will use to follow along is the handout, which I didn't know that there weren't going to be hard copies. So if you're hard copy people, well, you're out of luck. I was going to try to say something positive, but you have a digital version. So the digital version is on the app, but you will need the handout to follow along. There are a lot of details on the handout that so that way you don't have to write them all down. And there's a structure on the handout that allows you to follow along as well too. So let's begin with this. Let's survey, first of all, who are some of your favorite heroes from stories? Who are some of your favorite heroes from stories? Huh? Did someone say Thor? Yeah. Thor. Oops, let's see here. Okay, now why Thor? He's funny? Someone say he's funny? Yeah, humorous? Okay, good. Humorous. Powerful. Powerful in what way? Huh? Physically. Yeah. Physically powerful. All right. Thor? Well,
the
Thor.
The lightning.
Oh, you like that? The lightning. Okay, now Thor is now in popular culture, pop culture, because of comics, Marvel Cinema. But Thor originated from where? It's not from Marvel, right? Yeah, Norse mythology. So ancient Nordic mythology, all right? Similarly to, I mean, if you were to look in Greek mythology, you know, Hercules has been a favorite hero. What else? Who else do we have?
Captain Reed from Crash Landing on
You. Okay, and why do you like Captain Reed?
Because he's courageous.
And is it R-E-E-D?
R-R-I. Captain Reed.
Captain Reed.
Just Reed, R-I, like he's Korean.
Oh, okay.
R-I,
all right. And why do you like Captain Reed?
Because he's courageous.
Courageous? Okay, I'm just gonna leave it there. Courageous, okay. And what do we mean by courageous? Okay, so that kind of courage.
Yes.
Courage with sacrifice?
Sacrifice.
Okay, and you would said the word righteous, I think.
Yes, he's righteous.
Okay, good.
Because in a society full of corruption.
All right, okay. In the context of a corrupt society. Okay, good. Who else do we have? Samwise Gamgee.
Oh, yeah.
Why Samwise Gamgee?
Just incredibly faithful friend.
Faithful friend. I was wondering if anyone was going to say someone from Lord of the Rings. Faithful friend. Now, we're going to talk about Samwise in a little bit, in sort of a sidebar, okay, and why he's so important, okay, to the hero. Anybody else?
Captain America.
Captain America. Now, why Captain America? when he didn't have any power, right? Yeah, when he was powerless. Okay, so what was his power then? Really, was he truly powerless? Physically powerless, right? Okay, so this is going to raise some questions for us as we look at examples like Thor, Captain America, and these, a lot of these heroes, they're based off of thousands of year old types of character types, right? Thor is not new, Hercules is not new, Captain America was invented in 1938, I think. That's the character of Captain America. So you're talking almost a century old. These aren't new type of heroes. They become more popular in film, but they've been around for quite some time, and they birth out of certain contexts in history. Similar context to Captain Reed, you know, coming out of corrupt society, but showing certain quality types. Now, if you look on your handout, you'll see that there's a green box that is titled the Great Eight Traits in your handout, okay? The Great Eight Traits. And what the Great Eight Traits are, these authors, Allison and Goethals, did a sociological study surveying a number of people. I don't remember exactly the size of people, but it was well over 1,000 people that they surveyed, asking what are the qualities or traits of a hero that they perceive, both fictional and non-fictional. So they could be their grandmother, mother. And these were the great eight traits, the traits that repeatedly came up. And so there's something that is universal, constant in the way that we perceive heroes. They include being smart, strong, so powerful, okay? But it didn't always necessarily meant physical power. There was some kind of strength of fortitude, of character, of mentality, mindset, okay? Because can you have a powerful person and not be a hero, right? I mean, that's usually what we see in villains too, right? Villains are also physically powerful in some sort of way, whether it's muscle strength or physical in terms of some kind of physical ability or power, but that doesn't necessarily make them a hero, right? And we're going to talk about villains in a little bit as well too. The hero is selfless. So something like Captain Reed, someone like Captain America, there's a selflessness. Now, what if you had a hero character who was selfish? Do you perceive that character to be a hero? Why or why not?
Today
you might, okay, how so? Okay, now what examples can we think of in story that we think of where you have a hero and is that character is recognized as a hero but selfish?
Iron Man?
Yeah. Does Iron Man stay selfish?
No.
He doesn't, right? Yeah, in the first Avengers movie, he actually attempts to sacrifice himself to save all of New York City, right? So in the arc of the hero, the hero may start off selfish, and that's a vice. But the hero then discovers a virtue, and these great eight traits are virtues. The hero is defined by his or her virtues. Does that make sense? So the hero, in the end, is not even defined by how strong, like Superman. It's not about how strong or impenetrable he is. It's the fact that he wants to save people. It's the fact that he upholds a certain code of honor, of honesty. Have you ever seen Superman lie? I don't know if you've ever seen Superman lie. I don't know if I've ever read a comic book, watched a TV show. Yeah, Christopher Reeves. You know, I don't think he's ever lied. I mean, these actors are, of course, you know, fallen people as well, too. Yeah, let me come back to that, because that's going to be an important idea as well, too. But in general, if someone that you work for, your boss, is selfish, dishonest, a liar, no, right? We don't. I mean, you generally, society would completely degrade if we start to see our heroes as those who are selfish, dishonest, deceiving, and liars. And there's something to be said about this, and it's because of God's common grace at work. There's something already at work in our conscience where we perceive a certain code of morality that's benevolent to human flourishing. And heroes are created by society as symbols, as models for promoting human flourishing. Okay, so in the complexity of developing a character, that becomes a little bit different because of the arc that they're going to go through. But your hero is not going to end up as someone who is selfish, lying, deceitful, and only wants to care about themselves, right? So your protagonist, oftentimes there are stories, films, novels, where the hero may succumb to a vice. But oftentimes those are portrayed as tragedies. Does that make sense? So other traits, caring. Charismatic. Charismatic means someone who's influential. Resilient is going to be very important. One of the top qualities of a hero that you'll find is endurance, resilience, perseverance. Now, why is that? Why is that such an important trait for a hero in our stories? To have resilience, to have perseverance, endurance. Why is that? What?
To overcome.
Okay, now why is that? Why is it that even generally, whether you're a Christian or non-Christian, the perception of resilience is a virtue that a hero must have? Why do we perceive that, and why do we create that in our heroes and stories?
We need hope.
We need hope. Why does resilience give us hope? Never gives up. Yeah, never gives up, okay?
It's against death.
It's against death, okay? I mean, the greatest struggle, perhaps, is going to be, is the ultimate enemy for human beings is death, right? To think that there's a termination to life. I don't know how many of you have ever experienced watching a child learn about death for the very first time. Does that make sense? I experienced that with my son when he was very young, and he just saw a dead cockroach or a cricket. It was a dead cricket. And he just didn't understand death. You know, he didn't know what it was. He was so little. But watching his mind trying to process the end of life, it was something that was so hard for him to grasp. And it is counterintuitive. It is contradictory to everything that our cells and our body wants to do, which is to live. The plants want to live. The animals want to live. Aristotle says that life is direction-oriented. Life has a goal in it, and the goal is to live, right, naturally, okay? You naturally want to live. So death is the very antithesis of that, that is very mind-boggling. And so oftentimes in stories, one of the greatest things to overcome, even for the villain, maybe is to try to overcome death. But it drives them to villainy, because of the vices that they might have to incur in order to try to overcome death. We can't ever circumvent death, and this is where the gospel starts to come in. It was kind of in Peter Williams' message, right? That there's only one way to overcome death, right? Only one way, and that is through Christ, you know? But that very thing that is like a thorn in our side constantly drives the question that we're trying to answer in stories. How do we overcome? How do we overcome death? Now, back to resilience. Why is resilience so important? Why is it important, you think of, in life? That we can be resilient. Yes, there's an identification, right? One of the most powerful things about stories is identification. You know, when you read in a number of books, authors that examine stories and examine the archetype of the protagonist, there's one basic concept of the protagonist, the hero, is the hero shows us how to do it. And that's the basic thing that a hero introduces into society. A hero is what we call the schema, a schema. A schemata, yes, a schema. And this is what Alison Goethals talks about, is every society has a schema. And a schema is the heroes in your stories and the narratives that you tell, because they show you how to do it. So we identify. Why do we read stories and go to the movies? It's because we're trying to make sense of our own lives. And the resilience is a key virtue, because life is tough. You're constantly, Robert McKee, he wrote this book called Story, Robert McKee, and he says that if there's one constancy in life, it's conflict. Once you've solved one problem, you get another. You know, do you think when you hit 45 years old, all your problems stop? You've solved all the problems once you hit midlife, and there are no more problems left to solve, right? It never ends that way. You know, as a pastor for 19 years, I mean, I've ministered to people from their teens to their 80s. I've sat with people beside their deathbeds, and I've seen them and ushered them into the gates of heaven. You know, problems still occur all the way to the very last breath, and that sense of resilience, of never giving up. What's one of the most famous lines of Captain America in the movie? Before he becomes Captain America, when he's still Steve Rogers, what's one of the most famous lines of his? When he's just a scrawny little kid getting beat up in the back alleys, what does he say? I can do this all day, right? He never beats the other guy up by the bullies. He's getting beat up by the bullies, and he says, I can do this all day. And it's that resilience in him where he just doesn't give up, even if he gets knocked down over and over again. Now, if you start looking for this in films and stories, you see this repeatedly over and over again. Spider-Man into the, you know, the Spider-Verse, Miles Morales, the theme was, it's not about how you get knocked down, but it's about how you get back up, right? Is resilient. And that this is a key virtue for heroes, a key virtue because the main part of a three-act story, which we'll talk about in a bit, is a phase of trials. Trials after trials after trials. You ever watch a film where you don't really, or read a story where you don't really know what the problem is, right? Does it seem slow? It seems slow, right? Why do we have to have a... Now, on your handout, that's the next part that we'll get to, is the calling, okay? The calling of a hero. The calling of a hero begins with what? Oftentimes begins with what we call...
An inciting incident,
which has to do with what?
Something happens that turns their life upside down, and everything they know about life.
Yeah.
And it disappears, so they have to...
So it's a basic part... of a problem. Aliens are invading. Your wife suddenly wants to divorce you. Your family gets in a car accident and now you're a widow. You've hit financial problems. There's corruption in your job. You were doing really well in your career and then suddenly the boss you're working for is corrupt and your career is about to end. Okay. Some problem is the inciting incident. Okay. Now, why do we have to have a problem in the story? Why can you not have a problem in the story? To see how it's solved, right? So one of the things that heroes are here to do for us is heroes are trying to present to us answers, okay? Answers for what? They're answers for life, you know? Now, what story does this model follow after? What famous story does this model follow?
The Bible God, at the beginning, the story of Paul on the road to Damascus.
Even more basic than that.
The Bible.
Huh? Was it, what'd you say? The fall, yes. Right? Even more basic is the fall. Because when does the fall occur? In the Bible. Yeah, you're at Genesis 3. So Genesis 1 and 2 is your only time where you don't have a problem. By Genesis 3, you have the problem already. Right? So there's something that we resonate with in the very fibers of our being where we realize there's a problem. There's a problem in reality, and we're looking for a hero, and we need to solve this problem, right? And so, concepts of different hero types, what are different hero types that we have? Even this concept of a Messiah archetype, right? A Christ-like figure in stories. What's a Messiah archetype? Yeah, someone who sacrifices him or herself to save others, right, is generally a Messiah archetype, okay? And so a character like Harry Potter, right? Yeah, someone's going to say that, right? Harry Potter is a Messiah archetype. When I used to teach these workshops on finding God in films, I would teach this in the Midwest in the United States, and very conservative areas where most of the teenagers have never read the books about Harry Potter or watched the films of Harry Potter because of all the witchcraft that's in it. And I would show the gospel in Harry Potter. And the parents and the youth workers would be so surprised that there was a gospel message in Harry Potter because Harry Potter is tested, right? Part of the virtue of resilience is that you're tested through trials. You're tested through trials to the point where in the arc of that testing, there's an experience of the greatest ordeal, which is oftentimes leading to the death moment. How many times does Frodo die? He dies like 3 times, right? He gets stabbed by Mortseth Blade, gets pierced by a cave troll, and then he gets stabbed again by Shelob, the giant spider. That poor guy gets stabbed so many times, and each time we think he's dead, right? The hero experiences death moments. Why do we have to have a death moment for the hero? Okay, they do come back. Now, that is one of the greatest qualities of a hero is, can a hero come back? And there are times where even for the hero, they may not,
experience actual death, but it's something metaphoric to a death. Like if you ever watched Christopher Nolan's the third Batman film with Bane in it, and his back is broken, he's down in the pit. I mean, that's the death. He's looking up at hundreds of feet up and through an open opening, and it's his big task is to climb up out of the pit, right? Or that death moment may be depression, despair, where you just don't want to go on anymore. The character doesn't want to go on. It has to find some level of fortitude, some level of truth in order to go on. And that ties in with resilience, okay? Now, Harry Potter goes through a death moment in order for what? For the thing within him, the Horcrux, right, to die. And that's his only way to defeat the villain, is that he has to go through a death, which he didn't realize until he actually went through it. And then the big reveal with Dumbledore shows that he had to go through this death moment, okay? So we find within stories heroes that are, we tell these stories because we're trying to find answers. We're trying to find answers to atrocities. You know, we tell stories about hurricanes. We tell stories about natural disasters. We tell stories about AI apocalypse, which might be more real than we think now. We tell stories about evil wanting to take over life, right? We tell stories about why we invent Captain America, was to tell stories about battling evil in World War II, right? Why did Tolkien write The Lord of the Rings? Having gone through World War I and World War II, I mean, we're writing stories to create heroes to help us find answers, okay? What the heroes go through, an important concept is trials. Like I keep track of time here. Now the trials is what we would relate to in the three-act story structure to act two, right? Trials, trials, trials. It is what Peter Williams described as the Old Testament. It's your period of constant trials. Okay, and that is the bulk of, if you watched a feature film, that's the bulk of your feature film. I used to be a script consultant in Hollywood, and I would always look at Act Two. How well did they do Act Two, right? Act Two is how you develop the problems, the trials, and the pain, okay? The pain is key here. Now, why is that? And we're gonna relate this back to the villain as well, too. Why is the pain so key when it comes to trials? Those are not two separate things. Remember, what is a hero? A hero sacrifice. Sacrifice is the key, which doesn't matter if is your hero is your protagonist. It doesn't mean superhero. When I say hero, it is the archetype term for the protagonist. It does not mean superhero. Okay, so it can be any hero figure that has these traits: selflessness, smart, strong, resilient, okay? So do not mix up hero with superheroes. The hero could be your grandmother, as I mentioned earlier. It could be your wife, your husband, could be your hero. Could be your mom, your dad, could be your hero. Now, yeah, so there are two parts to pain, right, that we've identified. On one side, yes, there's an opportunity for development, okay? The other side of it is what? There's a negative side. Before the positive side of development, is what is so important about pain? Pain is what?
Real.
Real, yeah. Yeah, it's real, right?
I've experienced it too, basically, that kind of pain.
So the reason why, have you ever watched a film where the problem's presented, the solution's presented, but somehow, and you can agree with the solution, right? You don't disagree with the solution, and you don't disagree with the problem. You identify this is a real problem and this is an appropriate solution, but somehow you just don't care about the character or the story. Have you ever experienced that? Now, how does that happen when it comes to Act Two and how pain is dealt with? How is it dealt with? When is it poorly dealt with?
You want to relieve the pain.
Yeah, and sometimes, see, here's the part is you want to get to, sometimes stories, and this is why and that all depends on what we define as a good part. But Act Three, we want to relieve it. We want to relieve the pain, right? That's why we get to Act Three. Act Three is the climax and the turning point. But how we do Act Two is going to be critical. And why is that? It's because there's a psychology in storytelling. And the psychology in storytelling is being able to understand human pain. and suffering, conflict, to understand the complexity, the dynamics of it, and to give due justice to the pain that we go through. If you're going to write a story about depression, and your hero is going to try to overcome depression, and you have an answer for it that will come in Act 3, and the answer is probably an appropriate answer, but it doesn't feel appropriate if the pain hasn't been given due justice, where you've allowed the audience to sit in Act 2, where you've allowed the audience to sit in that pain for there to be an understanding of the pain. Some years ago, I had conducted an art event in Burbank. If you're not familiar with Burbank, it's right next to Hollywood, and it's where many of the entertainment studios are. And I did a survey of the city at one time, just serving people on the streets, my team and I did. And one of the top two psychological issues that people generally in Los Angeles face was depression. Depression and loneliness were the two things. So we had this art event where I had 12 artists, visual artists, and it was to tell a narrative. These 12 artists set their artwork around in a gallery. The first 5 artists could only depict depression. The next 7 artists would depict hope. But the first 5 artists, they had the task, the commission of, you're not bringing a positive message in. Your work is to capture depression. And people spent so much time just standing silently in front of the first 5 artists, looking at the artwork, and feeling like language was given to this suffering, this pain of depression. It was beyond the word, beyond verbal description, but it was depicted in art and imagery. Then once they felt like they had a level where they felt identified with, understood, there was emotional intelligence that was given to what they were experiencing or what they thought a loved one's experiencing. I had moms that were wrestling with their teenage daughters going through depression. But the artwork gave language to it. Then they moved on to hope. And it was a narrative, right? And sometimes in storytelling, we have to be able to give intelligence to pain before the solution that we present can make any sense. And that's what the hero has to go through, right? The hero in the Act 2 journeys, the hero goes through these trials in the story structure arc. The arc looks like this. Things might look pretty good in the beginning. Then there's a problem that develops. And then the hero may try some things that succeeds, and then it starts to plummet downward until you hit the greatest ordeal. And this is all Act 2 right here. Act 1 is in the very beginning, and then Act 3 is here. Okay? But the arc, before you can come up to the climax and then have a resolution, it is how we deal with the pain that is in between. That's so important. That would be a pain. Yeah. So if you feel frustration, that's a pain. So yeah, that's a good question. So what do we identify as pain? And oftentimes I think, at least in the 90s, you know, a lot of Christian stories, they didn't do as well because there wasn't a real understanding of pain. But this idea of pain within this broad concept may have to do with frustrations. You know, and that frustration creates that tension. It creates this tension that they have to go through. And that tension keeps you in the story, right? Okay, but these frustrations, they could be emotional pain, physical pain, financial, you know, struggles, whatever that might be, that's the pain. And it's the idea that you face conflict. And if there's another word that you can use, it's the idea of conflict. And that conflict has to be both internal and external. Okay, if you ever watched a film that had lots of action in it, but it felt two-dimensional, flat, and boring, even though there's so much action in it. And it's because all the conflict was in the external, and none of the conflict was dealt with on the internal. The internal is the Act 2 part of the pain. Now, why this is important is because it leads to what is the resolution for the Act 2 trials. What is it that the hero must actually do in order to resolve the trials? The hero has to learn some kind of truth. There's some kind of an aha moment that leads to what? That leads to character change. It is Iron Man who learns to not be selfish. right? He learns the truth of what it means to not just be utilitarian, but to be actually sacrificial, okay? It is the career-driven father who learns to value family, his children, and his wife. Does that make sense? It is some truth as the aha moment that the hero must learn. Any Hugh Jackman fans, Australians? Hugh Jackman fans. Well, there's a neat film that he did a while back called Real Steel. It was in, you know, on the surface, it looks like it's about a sci-fi film about robots boxing each other, but it's really a story about a father and son. At the heart of it, that's, you know, so there's the external and then there's the internal. The external is robots boxing. The internal is it's about a father and son. And what is the aha moment? The aha moment only occurs about 2 minutes in a feature film. That's all you have, because if you do act too well, it builds up to where you don't have to have a long sermon. You ever experienced films like that, where there's a long explanation as to what the answer is, and it's like a 10-minute long dialogue? Well, you don't have to have that when you build up act two, and it's only about a 2-minute dialogue. And that aha moment for Hugh Jackman's character comes from his 9-year-old son when he says, "Fight for me. That's all I've ever wanted, was for you to fight for me." And that's meaning dad fight for his son. And then you see the look in his face, and it just, like the light bulb just came on, you know, because he's a boxer. He's a boxer, and he commands robots to box. And then it's, the external becomes now a metaphor for the internal intangible truth that he had to learn in order for the arc and the story to change. If the truth is never learned, the arc doesn't change. Does that make sense? The hero does not get to the climax, okay? Now, why is this important for the audience? Why is it important for us? That the hero must discover truth in order for the story to change, in order for the character to change. Why is that important for us? That's important, yeah. All stories deal with meaning. So when you have an action-packed film that only deals with the external problem but doesn't deal with the internal and doesn't have the aha moment of truth and of development in Act 2 to that aha moment of truth, there's a lack of meaning. And as there's a philosophical term when there's a lack of meaning, and it's called reductionism. What we don't like in life is reductionism. It's to reduce everything just to, there's no meaning to anything. Does that make sense? Stories deal with reality, and what we want to find in reality is some kind of inherent meaning, meaning that matters, that's real, and it's not just relative or subjective. Okay, why else does this matter? Why else does the discovery of truth matter to us? Why is it important? That's exactly it, right? Yes, that's why in stories, there's a big reveal, right? A big reveal of here's the truth, or here's the lesson. And it has to come in a way that's through good storytelling and it's not trite, but it's something that we're all dealing with. So what it tells us is that heroes are schemas for us as models for life, not just to, it's not about the superpower. It is about the aha moment. You know, all stories are really dealing with one word. What is that one word? It is epistemological. It's epistemology, discovery of truth. If there's something that we're all trying to discover, is we're trying to discover truth. And that truth is instrumental for success in life. What is the truth about the universe? What is the truth about love and relationships? What is the truth about who I am and my identity? If you watch films, read books, it's always going to deal with that. Especially nowadays, the question of identity, who am I? Who am I? What is the truth about the meaning of life? And what is a good life? What is the truth of what happens to us after we die? How many films deal with the transcendence, the divine, right? And it deals with the afterlife, deals with the spiritual. Majority of films deal with these higher universal kinds of notions, you know? If you watch really good, any horror fans in here? I guess not too many horror fans in Christian settings. But some of the best horror movies deal with truth. Truth about humanity. Truth about what it means to survive the horrors that are out there. Okay? All right? It's epistemological. Yes, sir? Yeah. And so what we have are also tragic heroes. Right? Tragic heroes that portray to us in society that certain vices or the avoidance of truth or the lack of being able to change in character leads to a folly. Okay, so you have tragic heroes. You have villains that are also tragic, and we'll get to villains in a bit as well too. But just the mentioning of ancient mythologies. You know, this idea of truth telling through stories. It's an argument that Tolkien shared with Lewis in their understanding of mythopoeia. Right? Let me see if I spell this correctly. Mythopoeia. Okay. The truth is born through storytelling. Okay. And it's part of God's common grace. So this is one of the reasons why stories are so important. Okay. Stories in our own spiritual lives, especially when God's common grace is at work in storytelling, and we see his truth come through in storytelling. That can benefit our own spiritual formation. Because heroes are schemas for life. They're models for life. But they're also important because it tells us about the personality, the values, the perspectives of society. What does society value? What does society value about how it defines identity, right? Now, different stories will have different ideas about identity. Is identity simply self-autonomy, individualism? Or is identity bound within family or history? Is identity looking towards a higher being, right? Towards God? Is identity connected to purpose, all right? So there are stories that deal with the same question and presenting different possible kinds of ideas of what this basic fundamental question means. James Sayer writes that a question of identity and reality in the universe, these are core fundamental questions that human beings ask. And when it comes to philosophical questions that we ask, the average human being does not go to a philosophy book to try to find out the answer. They go to their stories. They look to the heroes, and then they look, I need to get to the villain. So in your handout, what does the villain tell us? Yeah. There's and something that Radina brought up to us earlier on is there's a complexity that you can develop in both hero and villain, where the villain might have certain heroic qualities. And what we start to see, and the hero can have certain villainous qualities. What we start to see is that the hero and villain are both characters, but they're also mass. Okay, this is something that Joseph Campbell writes about. When it comes to understanding archetypes, it's about mass. So mass mean that you can put on mass and you can take mass off. Sometimes the villain is predominantly wearing the villainous mask, acting according to what appears to be his or her nature. Okay. Then there's those gleaming moments where the heroic mask comes on. There's a moment of honesty, moment of compassion, moment of selflessness, right? What does this tell us? Why is the concept of mass important for us as an audience? Oftentimes, some of the best storytelling are parallels between the two characters and is a mirroring. And the arcs, if you were to plot out their arcs usually kind of go almost like this, you know, but they run parallel to each other, except that they go opposite. Because one chooses, in the end, a way of villainy. Vengeance and destruction is the way, while the other character chooses justice and righteousness, right? And your hand was up. Yeah, how many of us feel like we were a mass? Right? So the whole icon of the theater, right, are these masks, you know? And we wear masks. We put on masks. I mean, who in the world knows you exactly as you are? Every single side of you. Hardly anybody does, right? Except God. God knows you exactly as you are. The way you present yourself here, the way you present yourself to your parents, the way you present yourself in your loving romantic relationship, the way you present yourself when you're all by yourself and nobody sees you except God, right? We have different masks that we wear. And so these masks they illustrate a complexity of human beings. And we wrestle with this. And so Paul talks about this too, right? Put away the old self. Put on the new self. The new self is the redeemed image of Christ in you, and that's who you are in Jesus. So stop wearing the old self. So the language you find in Colossians 3, put off the old self, is literally a language used for actors in theater, take off the old clothing, put on the new self, put on new garments, right? So in theater, if you were to take on a character, you show up in your street clothes, well, you can't play the character in your street clothes. You have to take that off. That's your old self. Don't keep wearing that. Well, who's the new character? It's the redeemed image of Christ in you. Put on Christ. Put on Christ. Ephesians 4:24, right? Put on Christ, okay? And so you're supposed to put on Christ because your humanity has been redeemed according to a new schema, Romans 8:29, and it's Christ Jesus. You've been redeemed according to the Son of God, right? Not according to the first Adam, but you're now following in the path of the second Adam, right? Okay, so stories play this out for us. It deals with the intricacies of what we wrestle with. Remember, it's not just the external conflicts, it's the internal conflicts. The internal conflicts of you wrestling with, well, if I sacrifice this for my family, I have to sacrifice my career. So you're wrestling with your own dreams, your own ambitions, your own aspirations in order so that your wife or your kids may be able to have better joy or better provisions, right? So there's an internal kind of wrestling. There's an internal wrestling. Do you be honest? You know, if I'm going to be honest, it's going to cost me my job. If I just tell a white lie and I don't be honest, I can keep my job. There's the internal conflict that takes place, right? And so these are the things that determine between a hero and a villain in the end. Now the villain, what makes a villain, speaking of which? What makes a villain? We talked about what makes a hero a hero.
Deception.
Deception?
Deception.
Okay, that the hero is deceptive. So the opposite, right? Some may be selfishness, self-gain. Okay, the villain can be smart and strong. Yeah, that usually makes a very formidable villain, doesn't it? A villain who is actually intelligent and has strength, that's a scary villain. Yeah.
Can be resilient too.
Can't be resilient. They can also be resilient. That's really good. Yeah, if there were a category for fallenness, right, a category of traits, you know, the villain perhaps personifies at least some of those categories. The things that we don't like in ourselves, the wrathful side, the vengeful side, the side of I don't get mad, I get even. You ever heard that phrase? Right? The dishonest side, the side that we oftentimes may feel tempted to fall into. Okay. There is one, what Alison Goethals found, one trait that divides heroes from villains. So your villain can also be smart, strong, resilient, and that usually makes for a very formidable villain, but it's the concept of altruism, right? And what is altruism? Yeah, sacrificing for others is looking to the greater good of others, right? The greater good of others, okay? Now, why is this such a, if I can say it, a superhuman quality? Why would altruism be such a superhuman quality? Why is it so unique and special? Now, there's another word for selfish that's a little bit more positive sounding. What is that? Self? Huh? Self-centered. Self-centered is still a little bit negative, but something even more positive. Self-serving is still negative, but the most basic idea of self-preservation, right? So under a society or a belief where there's no God, there's only biology, what's the most basic instinct of any living thing? Is self-preservation, right? If there is no God, no soul, no sense of moral conscience, the most basic thing to our biology is self-preservation. To be altruistic is the very thing that denies that there's no meaning to us. Does that make sense? That there's no moral conscience in us, that there's no higher being or higher code or law above us. To be altruistic is the very thing that defies the most basic thing of our material self, okay? It goes against self-preservation. To make self-sacrifices for the greater good, for the good of someone else, to be altruistic is a truly heroic quality and something that Jesus Christ models for us in the gospel, right? To die for us and even to say, forgive them for they know not what they do while he's hanging upon the cross. You could not have a being, a person that demonstrates greater selflessness than that, right? At that moment of self-sacrifice, all right? Now, Loki was mentioned. I'm glad that Indrada mentioned Loki, because there's also something about the really well-developed villains and stories. And we go back to this idea of pain. Okay, what was Loki's pain in the stories? Huh? Neglected, you said?
Yeah.
Feeling neglected? Adopted? Yeah, he was adopted and didn't truly feel like he belonged. Now, is being adopted a negative thing? So what was his pain then?
Compared.
Comparative is probably a really good word. Also, abandoned can be a good word because of feeling perhaps abandoned by, you know, an adopted child can feel abandoned by their biological parents. However, the flip side, what's the positive side of being adopted? The flip side to being abandoned. You were chosen, you were accepted. You were accepted by parents who loved you, took you in as their own. So there's a flip side. So the pain has a complexity. Oftentimes a pain can be, yes, something horrible happened to you, okay? But on the flip side of that, is there something wonderful that happened? Now, how the villain then deals with the pain becomes very key in determining whether that character becomes a hero or a villain. Does that make sense? And so I have this on your handout there, the pain and problems, how they are dealt with, this arrow right here in between, how they're processed, how you heal from the pain, whether you latch on and internalize that pain, or you're able to, in a healthy way, process through it, find redemption in that pain, can determine whether the character becomes a villain or not. Because if it's not dealt with well, what are the vices that come out of not dealing with pain well?
That's when people become selfish.
Can be selfish. And some of the things we've seen may be like
vengeful,
angry, right? This kind of stuff, it's like Star Wars, okay? Anakin Skywalker is one of the best villains out there. And if you watch his transformation from being a little cute boy into Darth Vader, and it's the sense of loss, the pain of losing his mother, and it turns into wrath. And it, again, it's dealing with death. He's trying to control death and life. He's trying to deal with the pain and his fear, that tension, by making himself more godlike, right? And there's only one answer to death, right? It's through a Messiah, right? But he tries to become godlike using that's his vice, and using a means that is of darkness in order to try to control something he cannot control. But it comes out of a place of pain. A pain that he had not healed from or processed. So what is the value of villains in storytelling for us in society? That's right, can show us the future. It plays out for us. The villain follows a certain train of thought, emotional processing, emotional arc, deals with problems that we can all identify with, the pain we can identify with. And it projects for us, if you follow along this path, this is where you can end up. Right? This is where this view towards reality and life will take you. Now you put the hero and the villain together, and we mentioned earlier, right? Andrada mentioned about parallels. Now it shows us two examples. It's like first Adam and second Adam, right? When you look at some of the biblical villains, who are some biblical villains you can think of? Judas. Judas is a good one. What's the warning of Judas? What is the warning of Judas? He definitely had the vice of greed, right? John, the gospel according to John seems to illuminate that for us. He was always helping himself to the money bag.
Disillusionment,
that's a big one, right? Not to be walking with Jesus, but not recognize who Jesus is, right? And to betray Jesus because you don't see him for who he is, okay? Disillusionment is something that I think our society deals with a lot. They're grappling. You know, I heard a speaker once say that the question of this age is what? It's a question of, is it real? Is it real, right? Because of how many times have you looked at a image or a post and you wonder, is that real? Or is that AI, right? And it's a question, it's an epistemological question, I think. Is it real? Is it truthful, okay? What's another biblical villain you can think of? Saul, King Saul, right?
Yes.
King Saul. Now, what's the warning of King Saul? Now, he's kind of a tragic hero too, right? Because he was supposed to be the hope of Israel, right? The first king, all right? But he becomes a villain. And he becomes a villain very clearly to us when David enters the scene, and David takes on the protagonist role. Okay, now Saul becomes the antagonist. It's a real dramatic shift. Very nice, complex, nice in the sense of good storytelling. But what is the warning of Saul?
Jealousy.
Even before jealousy, though. Power corrupts. What else? Samuel said it to him in 1 Samuel 15, right? What was it? Yeah, obedience is more important, right, than sacrifices. It's faithfulness, total faithfulness unto God. But the problem to his obedience was something you refer to. It was his arrogance. Here's arrogance. After he won the battle against the Amalekites, he sets up a statue in his own honor, right? And so it's his own arrogance that became his vice and produced the lack of obedience. Where David, as the contrast now, is a man after God's own heart. Even though David was not perfect either, and we go back to that as well too. David was not perfect, but in the arc of the hero, in the end, does the hero bear the ultimate virtues of altruism, obedience, faithfulness to God, and benevolence to others, okay? There was one more before. Oh, so one leads to flourishing, the other one leads to folly. That's going to be your basic schemata. Is your heroes that you tell in society leads to flourishing. The villains that you tell lead to folly. Those are the two models, right? When you think of like Cain is another classic villain, okay? And what is the warning of Cain? So villains are warnings to us in society. Heroes are the ones that we're supposed to follow after, okay? The villains are not the ones we're supposed to follow. They're the warnings to us. Yes, that's a great question. And this is the higher calling in the Christian narrative is that you don't stay the villain, nor do you stay the victim. You are called to be salt and light in the world, right? You're called to put on the new self. You're called to be Christ-like. You're called to be imitators of Christ, to be imitators of God, be like God as he is perfect, as your Heavenly Father is perfect, right? And so in a story arc that looks like this, okay, and the changes happen because the hero learns truth, is changed and transformed, that leads to making choices. These are the three key things within that has to develop in Act 2. Okay? Now, the question of how are we heroes? Are we heroes? What do you guys think? Are we heroes? Yes. Now, in the gospel narrative, is Jesus the hero for us? Yes. In the gospel narrative, Jesus is the hero. We don't save ourselves. Jesus saves us, right? And that's part of the, perhaps then that's one of the truths that you learn, okay? Is that you cannot save yourself. That's out of arrogance, that's idolatry, that Jesus is the Messiah. Okay, and that's the truth, and that truth comes with transformation. The New Testament constantly talks about transformation, and that without transformation, you cannot succeed in the journey. Now, the danger of not seeing yourself, now when I say hero, it's not the sense of like glory. When I say hero, it's the one who goes through the journey. There's a sense of responsibility to the hero, okay? The hero to learn, to be transformed, and to make the right choices. Does that make sense? And I think one of the dangers of saying that in your life, the however many years God has given to you, that you're not the protagonist in the story, it absolves you of then learning the truth, changing, and making the right choices. Does that make sense? Now, is Jesus still the hero of your life? Yes. In the gospel narrative, Jesus saves you, okay? Do you go through a narrative where you're in Act 2 where you face trials and conflicts and suffering and how you have to deal with pain? Yes. Does that mean that sometimes the truths you have to learn is learning how to trust God? That's the truth I need to learn. And therefore, I change and transform by that truth and trusting God more so. And I make certain tangible choices in trusting God. And that changes the arc. If I never learn that truth, I never change, I never make the external choices that have to be made in the arc, never changes. Does that make sense? Okay. So in stories, you have a higher being. You have main characters and you have higher beings that are at work. You have Frodo and there's someone like Gandalf, who's like the wise, powerful wizard, okay? But it's Frodo who has to take the ring to Mordor. It's not Gandalf. Frodo was learning. Frodo, oh, back to Samwise Gamgee. This is a sidebar that's not included here. Sometimes what we need are right companions. We can't do it alone. Samwise Gamgee is not the hero archetype, but he fulfills another archetype, which is what? The companion archetype. Yes. Right, and the companion archetype helps you get through your journey. And sometimes it's the necessary means of understanding how do we invite that companion archetype, find that companion archetype, learn to trust and be vulnerable so we have a companion archetype, because the vice we might have is to think that we can do it alone, that I don't need anybody else. If Frodo did that, he would have never made it to Mordor. Because there's a scene, in the movie at least, where Samwise Gamgee says, I can't carry the ring for you, but I can sure carry you. And he picks up Frodo and hikes him up the mountain, right? Okay? So life, reality, are full of truths that need to be learned, right? Some of the most basic things, okay, you've had your hand up for a while, sorry. Yeah, that's a very good point. Now remember, one of the things that we want to look for when it comes to looking at the heroes of our society is who are the heroes of our society, right? And they're not always the kind of heroes we ought to follow, biblically speaking. Does that make sense? So the hero that says, I don't need anybody else. The hero that says, it's self-autonomy and individualism that defines my identity and not this greater sense of a purpose or a higher being, okay? Now, the model of a hero, going back to that, I need to finish up. I got like a minute left. If a hero is a model for a schema for how we ought to do it in life, who is the greatest hero of all and the greatest story of all? Right? It is Jesus. It's the second Adam, right? This is the greatest schema for us of what it means to discover our humanity, what it means to be human, how to do it, what kind of character qualities and virtues we're supposed to embrace. How do we go through this life all the way through the end, through our Act 1, Act 2s, and Act 3s? We have a model of Christ. Right? He is the greatest hero and the greatest story of all. So it's a story that needs to be told, retold over and over again, and by God's common grace, we find Messiah archetypes in stories, even written by those who don't know Jesus, but we find Messiah archetypes so that God's sovereignty is always reminding us about the need for Christ, always reminding us that there is truly one hero that we're supposed to model after and follow after. Now, for those of us who disciple, those of us who are parents, those who have others that look to us, do we bear responsibility? Like I think of my son, you know, do we bear responsibility of living such lives where we are going through our arc, being mindful of what we learn, the truths we need to embrace, the transformation we have to go through that requires humility? Even as a dad, sometimes you have to be humble enough to say, yeah, I was wrong about that. I'm learning, right? And then to make the right choices. And there are those who are watching us. And I think that's part of the economy of God's work through his church, is that there are those that we disciple. And even as Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. And there are those that look to us and how we live, right? And we don't necessarily pose ourselves as the hero because we point everyone to Jesus, okay? But there are those that also are looking to us in how we live our lives and the things we learn, the changes we make, and the choices that we make in this life.